and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is March 18th, 2026, and this is episode 590. I am the co-host, Mark Ames, in Western New York State. You're listening to Radio Warnerd. Subscribe and support the show. Join the Radio Warnerd Legion. Go to patreon.com/Radio Warnerd and support our show, please. Anyway, I'm on the line with the Warner, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher in Puglia. John, how you doing?
I'm good enough. I'm excited about this show, but I made the mistake of driving into a town tonight, and it was whenever you look at people you don't know in large numbers and you're already feeling sort of down, there's a deep sadness that can come over you. It's like I remembered a song that Alex Chilton, I think, did that you really liked. It was Everybody Goes As Far As They Can.
Oh, Holocaust, yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody goes as far as they can. They don't just care, or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's true. It's like, damn, and what are we're not very good at it.
Yeah. Well, then there's the little finale there, in case he hadn't dragged you down enough, which was, you're a wasted face, you're a sad-eyed lie, you're a Holocaust. Thank you, Alex. Thanks, appreciate that. Anyways, today we have a great guest, friend of the show, returning guest, Amr, joining us to talk about Bahrain and other Gulf states in the, well, we'll call it a war, but we'll see what it's called in Bahrain, in the U.S.-Israeli apocalypse war in on Iran. Just real briefly with Amr, in case you're not familiar with him or you recently signed up, Amr did a great series with us, the Arab Conquests series, about the incredible, out of nowhere, like Mongol-like rise of the Arab empire as Muhammad and Islam spread in the 7th century. And in fact, in one of those episodes, I think we did get into what would become the Shia-Sunni split, which is going to be very relevant for our conversation today. We also did an episode specifically on Bahrain with Amr, as well as a great episode on the Qatari sheikhs who were kidnapped while hunting bustards. And that was a fun one too. But anyway, Amr, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, guys. And yeah, it's not a war. It's the situation or the unprovoked Iranian hostility. Those are the acceptable terms for media in Bahrain.
Yeah, the unprovoked part, man. That one just gets me. Nothing happened. You're really saying nothing happened. Like, I saw a representative from the UAE, Amr, maybe you and I even shared some notes on this, but I saw her on some BBC and or Bloomberg or something, and very calm, very well-spoken, and just talking about, you know, the great offense to the UAE and how it's unprovoked. And it was like, well, you do know that the U.S. and Israel, you have anything to say about the fact that they bombed Iran first? That's totally separate. We don't comment on that. But what happened to us is completely unprovoked.
It is spiritually Israeli in the same way that October 7th was like a day that just exists outside of linear time and space.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. So today we will speak because Amr, of course, knows Bahrain very well. And has contacts there, and he's been sharing some of what he's learned about what's going on in Bahrain. I'm sure people have seen videos earlier in the war, before the real clampdown happened, of local Bahrainis cheering on some of these Iranian missiles hitting the U.S. bases. So I think before we'll explain why that's even happening in Bahrain particularly and the significance of all this. But Amr, I think at first just to, give people a general sense of what we're talking about here, let's speak really briefly about Bahrain, which among the GCC states, we might say is kind of potentially the weak link, or certainly the most vulnerable of the GCC states in some ways, maybe not, I'll see what you think. It is a small island nation, it's tiny, it's like, I looked it up, it's actually a third of the size of Rhode Island.
And it's sort of sticking out of the Arabian Peninsula on the east, on the Persian Gulf side, mm-hmm. almost due east of Riyadh, if in a straight line.
Right. Right, well north, well north of the Strait of Hormuz. As we said, an island or a series of islands and artificial islands, but the population, and this is where things get tricky. I mean, first of all, let's say it's ruled by the Al Khalifa family, which you got into in our episode with you. It was a British protectorate from 1861 to 1971. And after that, although, of course, the Brit influence would have been strong for a while, it became more of an American protectorate and ultimately the headquarters of the U.S. Fifth Fleet in Manama. And we'll try and talk about what that even means. But if I got anything wrong there, let me know. But I think I really want to ask you about what the population is and what the makeup of the population is.
So, more or less correct. The island is off the shore of the Arabian Peninsula. It's connected by one bridge, the King Fahd Causeway, to Saudi Arabia, which has been very busy recently because the blockade of the Straits of Hormuz means that Bahrain, where 90% of its food is imported, the food is coming by trucks now, which has led to this increase in prices, in particular in fresh produce, which I believe has gone up a lot.
Sorry, real quickly, this is a 25-kilometer road over the water, is that right?
Yes, yeah.
Is it a big multi-lane? It's like a bridge, basically. But
yeah, it's a bridge, but it's like a highway bridge where it's three lanes each direction.
Okay.
It's kind of a series of bridges, not so much a bridge as a series of bridges, because there's an island, a small island in the middle that acts as a sort of customs point for the Bahrain and the Saudi side.
Okay.
That bridge, there were sort of confusing videos a few weeks ago about whether that bridge was struck by Iran or not.
Right.
It wasn't. I saw rumors just before we got on that it was struck again. I haven't been able to confirm. But in both cases, it seems that the Iranians haven't attempted to destroy it completely. The strikes, such as they were, have been repaired quite quickly. But that's the last I heard. I don't know about this most recent rumor.
This is really important, though, because I know that people were talking about a bridge. I think they were thinking more of like a bridge over a river almost. But this is it for Bahrain. They can't get anything through the strait. And so this road is it, and it's already constricted enough that it's driving up prices of essential goods, it sounds like. So,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. If the
so
bridge
Iran
goes,
could take it out if they wanted to, it sounds like.
But it would be a huge escalation if they did
that.
Because
then
Bahrain would be under siege.
Exactly.
Going back to the population, though, it's about 1.5 million.
Mm-hmm.
The tricky thing is you have Bahrainis, expats, which are Westerners. The term expat usually refers to Westerners as a sort of loaded term. Labor migrants, which usually refers to South Asian and East African and Southeast Asian workers, also a loaded term.
There's a lot of talk about that, even among more self-conscious or PC Westerners in places like Kuwait. It's like you don't use the term expat. You want to say immigrant or something like that.
Yeah. It's very... The distinction is often in terms of the types of labor. I mean, the race, obviously, the background, the country, and then consequently the type of labor being done. You know, the white collar teachers who teach at private schools versus the builders and the restaurant workers and so forth. But then even within Bahrain, like what's considered Bahraini, you know, in air quotes, the royal family Al Khalifa, they're Sunni Arabs. They came from the peninsula in the 19th century. They came at the head of a tribal confederation and conquered the island from someone who was then a governor on behalf of Persia. And Bahrain had switched hands multiple times at that point between Persia, the Sultanate of Oman, the Portuguese for a bit. And when the Arab Tribal Confederation came, they kicked out the Persian governor and they made an alliance with the British in which they became a protectorate. Now, the Sunni Arabs of the peninsula are the minority, but they control the levers of power. You also have Shia Arabs, the Baharna. These are what would be considered the indigenous people of Bahrain, and they're Arab but Shia. And then you have the Ajam, which are Shia of Persian descent, who came in Bahrain in the 20th and 21st centuries. And then you have the Sunni Persians, of which my family is one. They're called Khudmunis or Holis. And these come from Lars province for the most part, and around Bandar Abbas. And this sort of the quadrant, if you will, like Sunni, Shia, and Arab, Persian sort of graphs, are also exacerbated by the Bahraini Sunni Arab tribes, their policy of naturalization, which, you know, it's always very touchy to talk about this because for people who are not familiar, it can come off as, you know, anti-immigration rhetoric. Especially in a region where citizenship is very difficult to come by otherwise. For Bahrain, it was always easy to get citizenship if you were a Sunni Arab from the region. So if you're a Syrian or Yemeni or Jordanian or Pakistani, it was very easy to get citizenship because the monarchy would give you citizenship in order to staff the certain organs of the state that were off limits to the Shia, the indigenous Shia. Mostly, this is security stuff. So the Ministry of Interior, the Ministry of Defense, the Army, the police, the secret police, all of that. Those are often staffed. And then there's also like a weird race hierarchy within those things where like Pakistanis are often at the bottom rung. And then you have the mid-ranking officers, which are Syrians and Yemenis. And then the highest ranks are Bahrainis and Jordanians in particular. And this sort of dynamic creates a weird fiefdoms within the state, where your sect and your background sort of determine both
and
access
resentments,
to resources. And that's the thing, that the difference between Bahrain and the rest of the Gulf is that the Bahraini royal family has and you know, you see it to a lesser extent in other countries. So for example, Kuwait have their Bedouin, their stateless population, which by the way is rapidly expanding because they're stripping people of citizenship left, right, and center. But that's we could get into that later. But with Bahrain, the monarchy has always treated its indigenous people as like a conquered subject peoples. And that's created all sorts of resentments, like you say.
During the Arab Spring protests, and we probably went over this in our Bahrain episode, but it was a few years ago, the way it was framed for a little while until the powers that be here decided that actually, you know, we need to save the royal family, was that the country was, you know, like 10 or 15% Sunni and like, you know, 70-80+% Shia. And as I understand, and I don't know if those numbers were right then, but as I understand it, the ruling family or the state went on a Sunniization program, which is maybe what you're talking about here,
yes,
to give out, to try to water down the Shia population. Is that right?
Yeah.
The Shia citizenship. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. 30, 40 years ago, it was definitely a hard majority Shia, like 70, 30 or so.
Okay.
But no one has done a census in 25 years, and no one wants to do a census because no one wants to knock around other people's doors asking them about their sex. That's,
yeah.
A difficult
be
thing
dangerous.
To do.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's believed that if Shia are still a majority, then it's more like a 55-45 at this point because of this mass and Sunniization project.
And you know, that happens in a lot of other places too. where Sunni Shia is a very nervous subject. Like in the southwestern part of the peninsula where I was living, there Najran is the big city, but it's very close to the Yemeni border, and it's very close to the Shia part of Yemen. And so the Saudis, who always have money to invest in any weird project, built very quietly a giant city that is about 20 miles inland of the border, basically out of artillery range. And they don't know what it's for. None of the local people know what it's for because, of course, the government doesn't really communicate with them. But they strongly suspect that if things don't go the government's way in Yemen, they will just collect all the Sunni Yemenis they can get and bring them to populate this new city. So it's a real weapon. People are really scared about it.
Yeah. It also reminds me a bit of Lebanon, where I don't think they've actually conducted a census since, I could be wrong here, but like since the late 40s. I mean, it's always, the Shias are still officially, I think, one-third, but roughly 30%. But it's assumed widely that they're probably even a majority at this point, if not certainly around 50% anyway. But you're not going to do a census in Lebanon, of all places, so yeah.
Yeah, I mean, demographics is always a very sensitive topic, both on a regime level and on a public level. And yeah, it's a very explicit arranging of the state around those lines but with Bahrain, I mean, it's a very stupid way of doing it because there was always enough resources to absorb enough people into the polity such that you don't build resentment. But we're governed by people who are both stupid and cruel, which is always an interesting combination.
Yeah. So, yeah, really briefly, could you describe also the, I don't know, the system of government? Because Bahrain did go through a period, as you talked about in our episode, of liberalization, and that came to a hard end. I mean, it could probably trace everything back to the previous idiots' war in Iraq, but certainly the Arab Spring definitely put an end to it. So it's obviously a monarchy, a feudal dictatorship, whatever you want to call it. But do the citizens and or the Shia have any rights in any way, or how does that work?
In theory, all citizens have a right to vote in our parliament, Majlis al-Nawab. It's a very weak parliament. It doesn't really do much. It can approve budgets, which always does, because no one wants to go against the grain. But it doesn't appoint the prime minister. The king appoints the prime minister, and parliament tends to just approve it. There's no real power in parliament. I mean, to your point about Bahrain going through projects, for a long time there was a sort of push and pull. When Bahrain first became independent of the British in 1971, there was initially a parliament with real power, but that parliament was suspended by the king's father, the emir. That's the other thing. Bahrain is now an explicit monarchy as of 2003, but that was part of a big push for reform by the current king, King Hamad, who took over from his father as prince, because Bahrain initially was a principality. It was called a state, but like the leader was called emir. And the quid pro quo was that he would establish a monarchy instead of a principality, and in return he would pardon a bunch of political prisoners, and let a lot of exiles come back, establish this sort of national constitution, and this sort of parliament, and there was a push and pull in the aughts around that. But that all came crashing down in 2011. That 2011 is sort of it foreclosed any hope of whatever parliamentary reform can exist within the monarchy. And since then, we sort of been living in its shadow. And to that point, one thing I want to make clear as well is a lot of people have been very excited online about the possibility of revolution in Bahrain. Mm-hmm. Everyone I talk to back home isn't so pessimistic or optimistic, however you want to look at it, in the sense that everyone on both sides, pro and anti-government, acknowledges that there is no organized opposition at all.
Right.
People are either in jail or in exile. One interesting thing, I was back in Bahrain in January, and one interesting thing I observed is that Bahrain recently has gone through a project not unlike Paris after its various revolutions, where you have these massive highways that were built in the last 10, 15 years to cut through, to connect major hubs and avoid going through the villages where the hotbed of opposition is. Mm. And that way the villages are sort of very easily isolated and cut off from one another and cut off from the main hubs. Because one of the big things that villages used to do was to burn tires on highways.
Right.
But again, there's really not any organized opposition anymore. There's anger and resentment, but there's no real mobilized force that would actually threaten the monarchy.
Right.
I remember Amr, one of the things that really surprised me, though it shouldn't have, I was naive, I guess, is that when we spoke to you on the show several months ago, I expressed surprise that there weren't more gigantic demonstrations against the war in Gaza or the massacre in Gaza, and that there wasn't more anger about it in countries that were not on the front line. And you thought that was a really naive question, as it was. And you said there's tremendous anger, but there's also the possibility that if you show your head, especially in anger, you'll get killed. So was that the case throughout the Gaza war?
More or less, yeah. I mean, a case in point was one of the leaders of the opposition in the aughts and 2010s, Ibrahim Sharif. He is a popular local figure, and he flew out of Bahrain, went to Beirut to a conference, and in that conference he criticized Israel. And when he came back to Bahrain, they arrested him at the airport and gave him a 6-month sentence for some sort of absurd crime. I believe it was insulting the dignity of an allied country or something of that sort.
Wow. An allied country?
Yeah.
Are they Abraham Accords? Did
yes,
they do it?
Bahrain signed the Abraham Accords, yes. Okay. Which has also fueled a lot of anger and resentment. Right. Which is not to say that people aren't doing anything. There's two expressions of anger in Bahrain. Inside the villages, there has been sporadic protests on and off since the start of the genocide in Gaza, but definitely over the past year or so. But those protests tend not to be more than maybe 100 people tops, and they're sort of, again, isolated and cut off. And then there's the Bahraini Society Against the Normalization with the Zionist entity, BSAZ. They really need to work on their name, but that organization has done like protests and demonstrations and marches, but those also don't tend to accrue more than at tops, you know, 50, 60, 70 people. And there's often a ratio of like 1-to-1 with cops in the area, making sure who's going there.
Plus undercover and, you know, all that shit.
Listing all the names, things of that nature. To the extent that there is anger, everyone is also very much afraid, and rightly so, because, you know, arrests go up during these times, and they have gone up since the situation with Iran. They've arrested dozens of people for posting sympathy with Iran, for posting videos, for cheering. A lot of them have been charged with treason. Which carries a death penalty, by the way. It's been...
You mean cheering the the missiles that are
the Iranian aimed. Missiles,
that are attacking the American base, which is quite unpopular in Bahrain.
Right, it is unpopular. Yeah, I mean, I think we need to emphasize that repression works, and that it can really suck the life out of you. But it can work in terms of disorganizing widespread resentment, anger, opposition, but it doesn't necessarily work in terms of getting rid of that sensibility. It just drives it kind of more underground and more afraid of organizing. But if it's not organized, it's hard to really do something about it. So they're just in a really tough place. I mean, there's nobody that supports them. Maybe Iran would. I don't know. I would imagine Iran probably until this tried to have more or less good tense relations with all the GCC states, including Bahrain. I would imagine. I don't know, but maybe less so with Bahrain because of the Fifth Fleet. What were relations like between Iran and the ruling family?
Tense. There's been no diplomatic connection since 2011. Mm.
They blamed Iran for the protests.
Yeah, and I believe since 2011. I think they tried to do a détente and then they canceled them again after the whole Nimr thing, which is a whole other thing with Saudi. But Bahrain has always been the most hostile to Iran and the least willing to negotiate or make deals. Funnily enough, there's an interesting sort of mirror between the Bahraini monarchy and Iranian nationalists, like hardline Iranian nationalists, mm-hmm. in that both of them claim that Iran has claims on Bahrain. Now, the monarchists use it as a way of driving fear and legitimizing their repression. And the Iranian nationalists just say it because they want to take Bahrain back. But that's, as far as I understand, and I'm not too familiar with Iranian politics internally, that they've always been a minority that hasn't really been a policy of the modern Iranian state.
Oh, because it used to be a Persian protectorate at some point.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so you have the sort of extreme cranks who think it should be that again. And then of course, but the Bahraini royal family used those voices as a way to legitimize their repression. One important thing I do want to sort of highlight and clarify: Bahraini Shia, even though they are sympathetic to Iran and are oppositional to the Bahraini monarchy, for the vast majority, do not want to be ruled by Iran. Their claim has always been sovereignty for Bahrain as a Bahraini independent state. And more importantly, the Bahraini Shia's like religious following. You know, Shia tend to follow a scholar, right? A marja taqlid, a source of emulation. A lot of them follow Sistani, and then a lot of them
the
follow
Iraqi
Fadlallah.
Shia leader.
Uh-huh. Yes, yeah. Uh-huh. So the sort of idea that the Bahraini Shia are sort of fifth column is
right.
Absurd, both on a political and a religious level, really. There is, like, I'm sure if you interviewed enough people over a long enough period of time, some people in Bahrain would support Iranian, like a Velayat al-Faqih style, you know, Ayatollahs running the country. But for the most part, that's not the demand, really.
Right. They're supposedly... Or I've read anyway. There's a large Sunni Iranian population, or minority at least in Bahrain. Is that what you said your family descends from?
Yeah, they're called Khudmunis or Holis. They're from the sort of southwestern part of Iran, where Bandar Abbas is. We speak a sort of Laristani dialect of Farsi. The Khudmuni dialect, which my dad speaks very fluently. I unfortunately don't. But yes, they're Sunni. The myth, and it's sort of very funny that this is a myth, but the modern myth is that we are the descendants of the Arabs who conquered Persia, and we're just coming back to we're returning back on the other side of the Gulf. I really don't understand why these people are so insistent on trying to make their blood pure of Persia. Yeah. It's very strange. That's a sort of common story that the Holies are Arabs who conquered Persia and are now crossing the Gulf and coming back.
You're the real OGs.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So getting back really quickly again to the population. So 1.5 million, does that include migrants and expats, or is that Bahrainis?
Yes.
Okay. So what percentage of that roughly would be Bahraini citizens?
It's really hard to tell. I would say maybe 50%, maybe 800,000.
Okay.
But yeah, that includes the naturalized Bahrainis as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So then we have to talk about, I want to talk about the industry there, and then we'll talk about the Fifth Fleet, and then we'll get into the war. Sorry about this. So industry is, of course, oil and gas, or mostly,
not
I think,
entirely.
Oil, actually. Get into that. Right, aluminum, of course,
yes.
too. But it was known as a major offshore oil. If you know, back in the 2000s, in the days of George Bush Jr., there were a lot of stories and scandal about the fact that, well, basically the Bahrainis gifted him a company, Harkin Energy, which had some kind of, or at least this is the story. I'm going off the top of my head. I can't remember it fully. It was like he got a Bahraini field or something, and that allowed him to claim he was an oil man and use that to kind of launch his career. And all that, of course, goes back to Pappy Bush, his dad, who was the former head of the CIA and an oil man. But as I understand it, then, of course, so you have the oil fields, which are depleted, are depleting, and they're not very large. Large refinery, and then because of, you know, water and energy, you have a huge aluminum smelter there. In fact, if I'm reading this right, it's one of the largest smelters the biggest aluminum smelter outside of China.
Yes.
Is that right? That's wild. Because Qatar also has a massive aluminum smelter.
And it's a state-owned industry. Alba runs Aluminium Bahrain, and it's a massive employer for a lot of people. I mean, for a certain generation, my dad's generation, the dream was always to work at either Babco, the oil company, or Alba, because of the generous money and benefits and so forth. Aluminium exports are our second biggest, along with oil. Those are the two main sources of income through exports. And because our oil, you're right, by the way, the whole Harkin thing is hilarious. Because our oil isn't what it used to be, we don't really have oil oil fields that are productive. A lot of the oil comes from Saudi, and we get to refine it and claim it as our own. That was a way for Saudi to keep the Bahraini economy afloat, because the Bahraini economy is one of the most debt-laden in the world.
That's why. They needed a bailout just less than 10 years ago. But yeah, I just saw their debt is something like 150% of GDP, which is pretty wild. That's like Ukraine level. They only pump 40 to 45,000 barrels, but they also share, according to what I read, another larger offshore field, or at least I guess this is how the Saudis help control them, with the Saudis, and the Saudis kick back some of the revenues from that to the Bahrainis. Is that right?
Share in the same way that you would share your school supplies with the school bully, but yes.
yes. Because the Saudis, we should remind people, the Saudis in 2011, when the Bahraini ruling family was under threat of potentially being overthrown because of the Arab Spring protests, they, I guess, couldn't fully repress the protests. So their larger neighbors, the Saudis, came in. The Saudis were busy also repressing their own Shia Arab population in the east. And then they came in and stomped out Bahrain's pro-democracy protests. right?
Yeah. There has been rumors that they've deployed the Peninsula Shield units again. They haven't. That's not true, as far as I'm aware. These are all the current movements inside Bahrain are Bahraini security forces, though they have brought in Jordanians as well. But that's a separate thing altogether.
How is that separate?
That's just their abundance of caution, but they haven't actually deployed them on the streets yet.
Yeah. I see. Okay.
So, Amr, I know you told us a lot of interesting experience you had in school with, and this is often very telling about sectarian countries or ethnically divided countries. Did all these groups, or did some of them, or did none of them, mix well, as teachers say, in school?
Before 2011, at least as far as kids went, it was very normal to just have friends of multiple backgrounds, etc. 2011 was strange because, yeah, I remember a lot of kids in schools, I was in high school at the time, I was in grade 11, and it was really weird seeing, like, because I went to a K through 12 school, right? Mm. And it was really weird seeing friends who were ostensibly friends since they were like grade one, sort of break their friendship over the protest in 2011. And not entirely, though largely, almost entirely on sectarian lines, on if you're Shia, you're anti-government, if you're Sunni, you're pro-government, etc. I mean, there were exceptions to be sure, but for the most part, that was how it went, and people, you know, lost friends and so forth. Since then, I mean, now my generation that grew up through that, there's this sort of we're all living in this. Like I said before, we're all living in this shadow of 2011, where everyone is sort of scared and tired, and everyone is afraid of talking about politics. That was not the case before. Like, even just normal conversations with your friends, there's always been since 2011, and even more so since 2023 with the genocide in Gaza, fear of what you can say and what you can't say, and like putting words into code and deleting text that you would send and things of that nature, largely because the government has gotten way more paranoid as well. But also on a personal level, people are just much more guarded. It's very strange to see.
Right.
Well, was it strange to go back to on your last visit?
Yeah, I mean, I met up with my friends and I met up with my family, and you know, my family are all over the place in terms of their politics. I met up with my neighbors who are very pro-government, some friends who are not so much that. But for the most part, for example, the Abraham Accords, right?
Yeah. What do they say about that?
The pro-government people praise it. I mean, the anti-government people hate it because it's embarrassing and it's humiliating. The pro-government people praise it, but they don't praise it explicitly in terms of, like, pro-Israel terms, but rather abstract concessions to dialogue and wanting to be friends with everyone, which is always funny because those people would never approve of the same accords with Iran, for example. Mm. Or similar diplomatic outreach to Iran, which is that there was an interview with Prince Nasser I think it was David Ignatius.
Yes. From Electronic Intifada. That was really good. Yeah.
Yeah. Where they ask him about the Abraham Accords, and then they ask him about Iran, and it's sort of like, well, you know, we like dialogue. We love dialogue, don't we? And then what about Iran? He's like, well, you know, Iran is a hostile actor, etc. We haven't talked to them since like 2018 or whatever it was. That sort of percolates into the public, in the pro and anti-government camp. But even within the pro-government camp, including people like my family, there is an anti-Abraham Accord strand, and they feel that that has been an overreach and a mistake. There's also, and we can get into this later as well, there's pro-government people who are dissatisfied with the Bahraini government's shift towards the UAE and distance from Saudi Arabia, which has happened in the last couple of years. One thing I mentioned to you.
How did that happen? Yeah, how did they make that shift?
In recent years, because the Saudis under MBS were pulling the sort of largesse that they were giving both domestically and to their regional partners. And then because, like you mentioned earlier, the Bahraini economy is not exactly healthy in that sense, in terms of debt, the Emiratis stepped in and started paying off people informally and formally. And there's also like factions within the Bahraini royal family, some of whom are closer to the Emiratis, and those sort of coalesce around the current crown prince. And so like the manifestation of that, a simple manifestation of that is, you know, when I went back to Bahrain in 2024, and even then before then, there were always these massive billboards and posters of the Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia and our king and our crown prince, like a sort of, you know, where we Saudi Arabia stands with us, we stand with Saudi Arabia. When I went back this January, a lot of those posters have been replaced with Mohammed bin Zayed.
MBZ. Yeah,
It's very, it's very strange how crude the propaganda is, how sort of very medieval. It's very person, it's person-based, you know? And so like all these pictures of our king shaking hands with MBZ and, you know, the UAE. And it's not that the hostility, there's no actual hostility. It's more of a decrease in closeness, but there's still, you know, when the Saudi Arabian National Day came, all we lit all our buildings green to support them, etc. There's still friendship, but there's a clear shift towards the UAE side of that split.
Some of these bets they made, they would make a lot of sense in theory. I mean, siding with the Americans, America's the most powerful superpower, okay? Abraham Accords makes the Americans happy, buys you more security. You know, the Israelis are all the way over there and they can help us provide, like, you know, some kind of nefarious security or whatever. UAE, well, they're the big rising power. That's funny. They call themselves Little Sparta. Do you think Sparta would be taking this shit from Iran or whoever? Like, they're not Little Sparta. They're not even little Venice. We were comparing them to Venice. I mean, in a sense, they were like that. But it's so clear ultimately that so much of UAE's power also, it derives from the American security blanket. But anyway, even within that security blanket, choosing the UAE, siding with them, is also turned out to be, granted, it was probably a smart bet, odds on, a few years ago. But this year, like, the whole house is coming down for MBZ, first falling out with the Saudis, and his their whole empire like collapsing, and then you know, and then this war. I don't know, what do you think of that?
I mean, to an extent, I still don't think that the Bahraini's bets are as smart as you portray them. But I mean, I have.
I'm trying to be fair here.
Yeah, and I know I'm biased. I know I'm not fair. I've been making fun of these inbred morons for the better part of 10 years. They piss me off because they're not even good at what they ostensibly are supposed to do, which is be feudal monarchs, right?
Right.
Because firstly,
they're not even doing Game of Thrones at all. They're doing
So, for example, UAE versus Saudi Arabia, right? UAE is a rising power. Yes, I agree. But if you're a monarchy whose power rests on suppressing a very restive domestic population, a large, not large, but like relatively large in comparison to your size population,
right,
on explicitly sectarian lines, at least the Saudis have a national guard that was built for domestic repression.
Right.
The UAE are not going to send their police force, and their police force is not good enough anyways. They're much like Venice. I mean, I don't know. I'm not too familiar with the Venetian strategy, but the UAE in particular hires a lot of mercenaries. Saudi Arabia at least has a sort of native security apparatus of Saudis in its National Guard. And you have the bridge, which means they can be sent over at any time.
Yes.
The Emiratis would have to either airlift their way in or take ships. And that takes time and more logistics. In terms of money, yes, the UAE has more money and they're more willing to give you money. But the Saudi economy is far more robust on the long term just because of its population and size. Now, granted, bin Salman is doing his best to negate those advantages, but even for something like as stupid as NEOM or the Cube or whatever, the flip side of that is that Saudi has been pressuring companies more and more to relocate from Dubai and Abu Dhabi to Riyadh if they want public contracts.
Right.
And to this day, public contracts in Saudi are still very lucrative. So if you're a company, you know, you either you stay in the UAE and you get less and less money, or you move to Riyadh and you get better public contracts with the Saudi state. Now, again, he's pissing his money away as well. As far as Bahrain goes, I've always thought, and this is something like people in my family who support the Saudi side have told me as well, is it makes more sense to ally with Saudi also because they're predictable. Like something like something like the Abraham Accords was a very stupid gamble on the Bahraini side. The desire was always for foreign direct investment from Israel. That was never going to happen. Why the fuck would Israel invest in Bahrain?
Yes.
They would invest in the UAE. Sure, yeah, the UAE invest in Israel back. But why the fuck would Israel put money in Bahrain? That makes no sense. The only other thing is software, like spy software.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was thinking. Yeah,
I mean, you know, they got access to Pegasus. Great, wonderful. Right. But then, you know, they already have everyone on lockdown anyways. Like, how much more surveillance do you need? But again, that goes back to like the cruelty, stupidity, and paranoia of our royal family in a way that all the other monarchs don't even come close to. That combination of characteristics.
So you mentioned that they don't have a homegrown enforcer elite the way the Saudis do, but who was shooting demonstrators when that little brief Arab Spring period started and Bahrainis were demonstrating in the streets of the cities
and the square and everything?
Yeah. The naturalized Jordanians and Syrians and Yemenis, which are sort of pejoratively called by the protesters mercenaries. Mm. You know, so you can use that term if it's a loaded term, obviously, but it's a very common term used to describe our security apparatus because they were the ones doing the shootings, the beatings, interrogations. The Jordanians are very good at that sort of thing, the secret police and the interrogations. Yemenis, Syrians, Pakistanis on ground level. The interesting thing is that the citizenship and the privileges they get is a function of them working in the security apparatus. So in a way, it sort of weds their loyalty to the state.
Yes.
You know?
You mean especially of the newer groups that were naturalized?
Yes.
No, that makes sense. So let's talk a bit here about the American base. It's not super easy to find out the actual makeup of what is there at the Fifth Fleet. You know, you get numbers from anywhere from like 8,000 to 15,000 U.S. servicemen, service people, I don't know what you call them now, carrier groups, expeditionary force groups, air patrol airplanes for, you know, the Gulf area. And then, of course, you know, fighter bombers, unmanned submarines, unmanned surface vessels, unmanned underwater vessels. Like it sounds like there's a lot there, but you can't really tell exactly what is there. What do you know about it?
The base itself is at a place called Jufair. It's a highly secure location in terms of like even the Bahraini military, you have to get special clearance to go in there. Even for like an allied, quote-unquote allied country, the Bahraini army and military are treated as sort of, you know, if you don't need to be here, why are you here? Fuck off. You're right in that it's hard to tell what's there at any given moment, and it changes all the time. It is a Navy base, so almost everyone there is in the Navy arm of the U.S. military. Mm-hmm. The CENTCOM has at various times been there, I know they have a base in America, an actual like headquarters in America, but whenever CENTCOM needs to go to the Middle East, they tend to stay there as well. The size, I believe last I heard it was 8,000 to 10,000, but I believe during this war that expanded. They say that they emptied the base, but what they really did was remove all the soldiers and put them up in hotels. So, mm-hmm. you know, speaking of soldiers, by the way, just as an aside, one of the reasons the base is quite unpopular among Bahrainis is that these soldiers tend to go to this place called American Alley in Jaffa, which is like this one street that has like all these like honky-tonk bars. They go there, and the other two demographics they interact with in these bars are sex trafficked Filipinas and high school girls. And a lot of the high school girls in the private schools would quote unquote have boyfriends who are American military members. And I'm talking about like 14, 15, 16 year old girls with like 23 year old soldiers. I mean, you know, it's not... When the Iranians call the American military the Epstein force, you know, it's not entirely unfounded, I would argue.
What do the parents think of that? Or what does society think
of
that?
No one wants to talk about it because of shame. No one wants to touch that. First of all, because of shame, and second of all, because the government doesn't want to touch it. Yes. And third of all, because even if the government did raise it, they'll just the Americans will just pull the soldier, a particular soldier, away. Yes. And like what they do in Okinawa or elsewhere.
Exactly.
Right?
I was thinking of Okinawa. Yeah. Okay. So this base, is it? I mean, so people kind of resent it. Is the presence really front and center in the sense that you see American military hardware?
It's
a small country, you don't even
it's,
the ship.
It's hidden behind like layers and layers of wall and walls, and you know, it's very. It's an area no one goes there unless you need to go there, and everyone sort of tends to avoid it.
So it's very secured then.
Yes.
So does everyone there know now? Understand that thousands of service people were moved to, basically the Bahrainis are serving as human shields now for the Americans. Is that causing resentment? Because the Iranians seem to have some good intelligence, and as far as we could tell, they've hit some hotels where the American service people are staying.
Yeah, so I mean, it's causing a lot of resentment because a lot of the soldiers are in hotels that are next to villages that are opposition villages. So not only it's a very sensitive topic. I mean, it's not just the hotel thing too. It's the American hardware, the anti-air, whatever you call it, interceptors, the launchers for the interceptors. They're placing those in areas that near Bahraini population centers, and that's caused resentment too. The interesting thing about the strikes on the hotels is that yes, that the direct targeting of rooms that the Iranians knew Americans were going to stay in, it shows that there is intelligence on the ground, not just signal intelligence that the Chinese are providing, but like actual guys pointing things out, which Bahrain has been trying to clamp down by just arresting the usual suspects. And, you know, they'll round someone up, put them in an interrogation room, get them to give them a list of names. But like, I think personally, I don't think they're as accurate as the Bahraini, like as the Bahraini press say they are. I think they're just arresting anyone they think is
affiliated. It's always like that, and that works also against them because then they wind up arresting the wrong people. More resentment, exactly.
Yeah.
But that's why it's you've helped set up what's going on there so well in terms of describing the sort of the sectarian divides and this and the stupid and cruel ruling family and the resentments, and that gives a really good understanding then to why Iran would have good human intelligence there. However, it is passed on, you know, God only knows, but it does seem like that. So it makes a lot more sense. I think I remember seeing as this was going on, people, I mean, you know, you can only know so much about so many countries. And I think a lot of people were sort of like, why is it in Bahrain they're cheering them on? You know, what, like, does that mean everywhere they're cheering them on? Well, they're not cheering on Iranian missiles everywhere. Definitely in Bahrain they were. Can you maybe describe what you've heard from people there about Iranian strikes, missiles and drones, and how many are intercepted, and like, you know, how often it's happening, what is being hidden or what's being told? Like, what's the sense you're getting from people there?
It comes in waves. Today they've had the alarm a few times, the sirens. Before that, there were no sirens yesterday. There were some sirens the day before. It seems that, as far as I understand, and I'm combining this with people I know in Dubai and people I know in Qatar and Kuwait, the Iranians are striking different countries on different days. They sort of go through this sort of rotation. The Bahrain is getting hit this evening. Last I checked, our refinery got hit, I believe, or the LNG facility got hit. But as far as I'm aware, a lot of
it's the main refinery, right? That's a huge business there. Uh-huh.
Yeah. A lot of the drones are getting through. It doesn't seem like we have a lot of interceptors left, if at all. Which, speaking of interceptors, by the way, there one thing that I want to touch on just a little bit is there was a death, the first Bahraini who died. So there have been a couple of migrant workers who died in a fire in the first few days of the war. Or sorry, the situation. But last week, I believe it was this woman, this poor 29-year-old woman, died in a debris. Debris fell on her. It was an interception that fell on her.
So the interceptor debris from the actual interceptor.
Yeah, okay. Which is just to point out that for the most part, Iran hasn't really targeted residential areas. They've been going after the base. They've been going through infrastructure. But the biggest threat really is the interceptions. The debris from the interceptions has been the biggest danger to the ordinary citizen. The other thing is that there was 31 people got injured in what the Bahraini government says is an Iranian drone strike on a village in Sitra. But there was a video that was posted and then it was deleted and then people got arrested for posting that video. And it looked like, and I don't know if it is the same strike because again, it's very hard to confirm these things. And everyone is so afraid of seeing anything now. But it looked like it wasn't a drone strike. It was one of those misfired interceptors that went up and then back down in a parabola-like way. But the Bahraini government doesn't want to accuse the Americans of misfiring an interceptor and so have said it's a drone strike. That injured 31 people. That was a pretty bad hit. In Kuwait, an 11-year-old girl died also from debris hitting her home. But to your point about the strikes going through, it does seem that the Iranians aren't using ballistic and cruise missiles as much as drones, and the drones are coming through. And also, some hardware has been moved out of the Gulf to Israel, which is exactly what you want to do to make all of your allies happy. That is a very good move.
You mean the Americans are moving out some of their anti-missile systems to Israel to protect holy Israel. Yeah, they'll protect the Israelis over their own soldiers. It's absolutely amazing.
You could correct me if I'm wrong here, but I genuinely believe America would protect Israel over maybe 30, 35 of your actual states.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Like we're Arkansas I could and name, Kansas, one of those places.
No.
We could name the states.
Yeah. It's definitely would. And I think a lot of Americans would prioritize protecting Israel over certain states, not over America itself.
And even people from those states. It's we're not much.
It's a weird pathology. The Iranians did, one of the first things they did was take out, a bunch of radar. We talked about that a few episodes ago. THAAD radar systems, radar domes,
One of the radar domes hit in Bahrain. I was told that the operation could take 2 years, 2-3 years.
Yes.
Just being told this by an engineer I know. The hits on the radar has made it such that the sirens still go on and off depending on whether the drones are being tracked. But as I understand it, the faster ballistic missiles aren't being tracked as easily because of the loss of the radar.
And yet the missiles are the ones, if they can shoot something down, they're shooting down the missiles, but a lot of drones seem to be getting through. As I read something about how that drone that Iran says they didn't fire, I kind of think in this particular case they did, the one that hit the Omani refinery all the way over near the border with Yemen, and they're like cruise missiles where they can fly really low over the water. And they use now Russian, they kind of have Russian redesigned chips, and they're using either the GLONASS, the Russian kind of GPS system, or the Chinese GPS system, and so they're a lot harder to hit, and they're not the priority. I think so much, like drones have been I think they misunderstood. They learned the wrong lessons that, well, the drones we don't really have to worry about, because like in the 12-day war or in April 2024 when the Iranians launched their first salvo at Israel, the drones were kind of the easy pickings. It was the missiles they had to worry about more. And it's turned out in this war in a lot of places, I mean, all over the Gulf, the drones have actually caused a lot of the damage. I don't know about Israel, but definitely in the Gulf states. What have you heard about the drones themselves? Have you heard anything on this, on
that
sort of missiles?
That's what
drones?
I understand is a lot of the strikes are drones that are getting through and they're causing damage. A lot of it is infrastructure damage, which makes it more sense, makes more sense that the drones are causing that much damage because, you know, refineries are notoriously fragile things.
Yes.
And they did hit
the desalination plant. Right. Yes. Because Bahrain really relies on desalination. And that was sort of like the Israeli Americans, may as well just call them one at this point, did a sort of test. You know, I don't really, the thinking is so bizarre. Anyway, they bombed an Iranian desalination plant. And the Iranians are like, you got to be kidding me. This is like the one thing that's, you know, that you're most vulnerable on. So they hit a Bahraini desalination plant.
They hit the Bahraini desalination plant because the Iranians claim, with some justification, that the strike that hit their desalination plant came from Bahrain.
Right.
So it was an eye for an eye. Right. The thing about desalination plants, there was a Euro Radio Warner discussion about this with some of the community members, and I've come to be convinced that it's not as fatal as initially assumed, because a lot of that infrastructure can be repaired. It's not as explosive, for example, as a refinery, but all Iran needs to do is make it such that you don't know when you can send mechanics out there to fix it. Right. If they hit at an unpredictable pace and tempo, they can just make it impossible to go fix the plant. Now, the other problem is that, so you have the desalination plants, and then you have the fact that a lot of water is also like bottled water that's imported in, and because the streets are closed, that water isn't coming through as well. So again, it goes back to the trucks on the bridge, and you know, things are getting more tense in terms of how long these supplies will last and how expensive they will get. It does seem that Iran has Their escalation in terms of, for example, the desalination plants, as you mentioned, is very much, if you hit ours, then we will hit yours.
Right.
They did the same with banks, by the way, in Qatar and in the UAE. When an Iranian bank got hit, that's when they hit the banks back.
Yes. And then today, of course, Israel, with Trump's blessing. I don't believe these guys are doing anything yet. I don't know, without... Like, Trump and the empire should not get off. I mean, Israel we know is evil, but we shouldn't pretend that poor Trump and the poor empire. Like, as far as I know, as far as I've read, the Americans gave the okay to the Israelis, or agreed or greenlit it, for the Israelis to hit the South Pars gas field. It's the Iranian gas field. This is sort of in the northern part of the Persian Gulf, right? I mean, it's well north. It's off Qatar. It's like there's Qatar, and then there's, you know, the Persian Gulf, and then on the other side is Iran. And it's a massive gas field. The Iranian part is called the South Pars gas field. And then there's the Qatar part, which is the north something gas field. Yes. And for the Iranians, it supplies 70% of Iran's natural gas, but it also supplies 15% of Turkey's natural gas. This could be really screwing Turkey, which of course the Israelis would love to do. The Qataris, so anyway, they hit this field. Then I saw in Israeli media, they said, this is basically a warning of what we're going to do and that we could basically decimate this. This is like they think they have a silver bullet, whether it's hitting the South Pars gas field or taking Kharg Island. As if the Iranians, I mean, if there's one thing by now you should understand, they've gamed all this. You know, they have an answer for these things. So the Iranians then targeted a bunch of oil and gas infrastructure. The Ras Laffan refinery in Qatar got hit. They had made an announcement about that. They announced that they were going to hit, I don't know if they did yet, a big gas field in the UAE. And then two complexes in Saudi Arabia, including this Samref refinery in Saudi Arabia on the Red Sea. So that's all the way on the other side of the peninsula. I don't know if that's been hit yet, but that was announced that the Iranians basically said, if you're at the Samref refinery, leave. Because we're going to hit it.
Which would be interesting if Iran chooses to hit it itself, or if they bring Ansarullah law into play. Because so far, right, the Yemenis haven't really done anything. They've announced that they're going to participate in the war at some point, but they haven't actually launched attacks. If they get in, things are going to get very ugly very quickly. I mean, things are already ugly as is. I mean, you know, we talk about the hit on the oil refineries. By the way, one of the more interesting aspects of this isn't just the price of Brent crude. It's the second order effects. These refineries make a lot of byproducts that are very important to the world economy. Sulfur is a big one. A third of the world's sulfur comes from the Gulf, and that's used in fertilizers. And it's planted season right now in a lot of places in the world. And those fertilizers aren't being made because that sulfur isn't coming out. Also, the sulfur is used in fabrication for chips, for electronic chips. So
the helium,
sulfuric acid,
but the helium from Qatar.
The helium from Qatar and the sulfuric acid from Kuwait and Saudi to wash the chips. These are both very important for electronics, so the prices of those are going to go high, which, by the way, the effects of that on AI, the AI boom, is going to be very interesting. It's just right now, even before, like up until now, if the war was to end tomorrow, sorry, if a situation was to resolve tomorrow, there are certain economic consequences that are already baked in that are going to make it very, make the rest of the years and next year as well very difficult. And that's like if the war was to end tomorrow.
Which it's not.
Not only is it not, but if it escalates and if, say, Ansarullah enter and they start attacking Saudi refineries on the Red Sea and they block Bab al-Mandeb, so both sides are blocked now, that's good. I don't know where we go from there. One thing Cyrus said in your earlier episode that I stuck with me and I completely agree with is there's no going back from this. We've now entered through the looking glass. There's whatever the region after the situation, whatever the region comes out, it won't be the same region that was there since before October 7th.
Absolutely. So let's talk about this, and I don't want to keep you too long, but I was talking with somebody about, you know, sort of different kind of intelligence reports and scenarios about where this could go. And one of the kind of semi-doomsday scenarios, I think more from the Western point of view, well, definitely from the Western point of view, is if any of the GCC states basically breaks and says, we can't keep getting hit, we need to come to a deal, and is no longer, you know, of course, none of the GCC states now are openly siding with the U.S. and Israel, because that would be, you know, for a lot of obvious reasons. But it's also kind of kept Iran, except for the UAE, because of the UAE is obviously besties with Israel and they barely hide it. But that's kept Iran's own attacks on, let's say, Saudi Arabia and Qatar at a much lower level. But if one of the states, and just literally any one of them, were to break, that it's sort of like all bets are off kind of thing. Like it would be the thing that would completely, you know, overturn the table, which has already been overturned by Trump anyway, but would be re-overturn it, and nobody knows where the hell that would lead. And the thought is that Bahrain might be that weak link because it is so vulnerable. It is so vulnerable. It's creaky. Now, it doesn't, I think, as you said, it's not like there's going to be a revolution.
Can I jump in? Sorry. Yeah. I will say, I don't know which state will be the first to break from the U.S. and Israel, but I guarantee you Bahrain will be the last.
I know. That's what I was
going to say. Our royal family are so stupid and so lacking any strategic vision that they will watch the island burn before they...
I was going to say, I could see the island sinking and they're the last ones on it saying, you know, stay here, we're about to turn a corner in the situation.
But, you know, there have been expressions of resentment from many Gulf states. I can't remember exactly which ones were saying this, but
Qataris and the Kuwaitis,
Kuwaitis, yeah. Oman.
The subtext was basically like, you know, we paid you for protection, and we're not getting any protection. And
that was actually an Emirati. That was a UAE oligarch who I think also was saying that. Yeah, but you're right. I mean, out of pure like inbred stupidity, the Bahrainis would actually probably be the last. But they may. That's only if it's a choice. I mean, the place may implode. It may. It is. It's so physically fragile. If Trump decides to say, like, I'm not going to be the one who is going to be cornered here. I'm not going to be told that you can't attack Karg Island because that's going to blow things up. I'm the one who decides, and this is Trump, you know, I'm not going to be put into a box anywhere. If I'm put in a box, I'm going to break out of it as a matter of principle. And if that happens, it would just seem that Bahrain could be basically destroyed more easily than the others. Maybe Qatar would be the next most. Qatar would seem to me maybe more vulnerable because the Qataris already have one foot not in the U.S.-Israel alliance as it is, and they have so much to lose.
The Qataris are certainly a lot savvier. And diplomatically, they've always played this game of not ever committing to any one side. And that goes back to distrust between Qatar and Saudi, all the way back to the 90s, when Saudi organized a coup against the current prince's father's father, I believe. I could be wrong, but there was a coup. There was a successful coup organized in the 90s by the Saudis, and then an unsuccessful second coup by the Saudis that reinforced Qatar's fears that they need to diversify their alliances, which is why they've always been very close with Turkey. They've been fairly amicable with the Iranians. Mm-hmm. But in terms of things blowing up, I mean, the thing about Bahrain, though, is that as fragile as a lot of things are there, the security apparatus has got things on total lockdown. It's far less likely to implode unless... And this is the one wild card would be if the economy starts screaming, right? I just saw today they announced that a couple of interesting announcements in Bahrain. Firstly, all loan repayments have been suspended for 3 months. So individuals don't have to repay their loans for 3 months. And that 3 months, it won't accrue interest. So even if you're not paying, so you could tell things are getting hairy. And the other thing they announced was that the Bahraini sort of... Social Security organ is going to cover partial. There's details are sort of weird, but the Bahraini government is going to cover private sector salaries to maintain jobs to prevent job loss.
It's kind of like COVID when we briefly in America had we briefly had a kind of welfare state here. It felt pretty good for about 5-6 months, and then Biden came in and. And then it brought in austerity and couldn't understand why he lost. But yeah.
Both those things suggest that the economy is teetering. It's not teetering. Maybe that's excessive. But there are cracks showing.
Yeah.
I mean, the before this situation started, the Bahraini economy was set to be their budget for this year was that they were going to add another 10% of the GDP to their debt. So that was before this war. So like whatever debt we get now is going to be interesting. And Bahrainis themselves are also, a lot of them are in debt, like as citizens, not just the country.
Wow, so it's debt, but public and private debt is a problem.
Interesting.
Maybe they should do a jubilee like they used to do in the old biblical days. I mean, I wish we had one here, but yeah.
The old prime minister, the uncle of the king who passed away a few years ago, used to do that every so often. But he would do it, I mean, very, very narrowly. But he was it was very interesting because he was very sectarian in many ways, but he was also he ran the country in a much more effective feudal manner, by which I mean he understood that you had to like give and receive. It was very much a balancing act, whereas whereas this current crop are very neoliberal in their economic outlook. They're very much Thatcherite, especially the current crown prince. He's a true believer in that sort of thing. But the fact that even he's willing to pause loan repayments and whatnot is interesting. But going back to your point about like Bahrain imploding, I don't think that's likely. Again, everyone I've talked to said that the security state has been on total unchallenged ascendancy since 2011. And so much as a whiff of dissent has been crushed hard. But there's also a ceiling to that level of repression, right? There's there's a hard ceiling to how much you could keep pitting people. The only response I would give to that as well is that, unfortunately, I mean, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on where you stand, Bahrain being a very, very small island means that it's not exactly Syria or Libya where you could smuggle arms. The extent of opposition violence, such as it was, has always been tire burnings and Molotovs. But then, and you know, that's because there's never been guns in the arms of the public, and there can't be just geographically and functionally. So that, on the one hand, that's insulated Bahrain from the worst of the region's troubles in terms of like an apocalyptic civil war like Syria or like total state decay like Libya. But on the other hand, it means that the government can always crack down without fears of actual violent retaliation.
Well, presumably Saudi would just send people in some kind of air mobile operation to crush any rebellion, or is Saudi that interested in the regime?
If push comes to shove, I mean, as unfriendly as the, or maybe unfriendly is a strong term, as distant as the current royal family has gotten from Saudi, I do believe that if push comes to shove and if things get tense, the Saudis will intervene. They would rather sink the island to the bottom of the sea than let an unpleasant regime on their doorstep. Unpleasant to them.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So one thing you and I were talking about were these reports that the Saudis were, these reports that were in the New York Times and Washington Post. And I actually went back and looked at them again, and they're very weird. Because it's like the New York Times version had like 10 bylines, including, of course, Ronan Bergman's, the Israelis, but alleging that the Gulf states have actually been egging on or encouraging, pushing the Trump administration along with Israel, you know, to bomb Iran, and that the Saudis in particular, MBS in very particular, was saying, hit them harder, hit them harder. But when you actually go back and look at the articles, it's a very small part of the article. It's like four administration officials said this. And then the article just tells a whole bunch of other stuff. Like this is a very huge thing. And it would, if it's true, it's very strange. It's kind of put in there in both the New York Times and Washington Post article, and then, but not really developed at all, and then really used to frame the support for the war, how it's much broader and deeper. We just don't know. You're skeptical about it, right? Because I'm skeptical myself.
I am very skeptical. I mean, you know, stranger things have happened.
Yeah.
You know, it's not entirely impossible. But as I understand it, and as far as I've asked around, the Saudis would not like this. I mean, you know, they've reached out to China before to establish détente with Iran in 2023, and bin Salman has sort of withdrawn from open confrontation with Iran, and that's been one of the big factors causing the schism with the Emiratis, has been the extent to which Saudi Arabia is no longer interested in foreign policy adventurism the way the Emiratis are. So I'm very, very skeptical of these reports. In fact, my theory has been that these are being leaked by the Emiratis in particular to try and get the Iranians to attack the Saudis, to drag the Saudis into a broader confrontation because the Saudis, interestingly, when Iran responded initially, they've been concentrating on Kuwait, Qatar, the UAE, and Bahrain. The Oman has been, you know, they say that they haven't struck that one refinery that one time. We don't know. Saudi Arabia, they were avoiding hitting them. And the initial wave, they said that, you know, there was some strike in a refinery in the east, and the Iranians said it's a Zionist false flag.
Yes.
Now, that claim has stopped. The idea, the Iranians have increased their strikes on Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis have been intercepting strikes, but it's still a much lower tempo than the rest of the region. So there's clearly some sort of understanding there, or maybe some caution on both sides so as not to escalate. But I wonder if the Emiratis understand that the caution exists and want to torch whatever détente exists between the Saudis and the Iranians. Yeah. Because the Emiratis are getting hit hard. Like the Dubai's airport got hit, their fuel tanks got hit. Yeah,
the part of the Emiratis, the refinery that's on the other side, the southern side of the Strait of Hormuz, which presumably would be how they would safely, you know, avoid that blockade that the Iranians have. That's getting hit as well. They're getting hit very hard. And not only, I think so far the UAE, maybe Qatar as well, but the UAE and Qatar are the really rich ones. And the UAE's, I mean, I was reading about it. Dubai was a city of 900,000 people, I think, in like 2000 and up and coming. And now it's a city of over 4 million people. And it has, you know, hundreds of thousands of wealthy, as you'd say, expats, you know, wealthy Europeans, Americans, Brits, Russians. And it just has its ability to attract these people is that there's a lot of money and it's a safe place. And it just, I don't know how they really come back from this unless there is total regime change in Iran, not chaos, not breaking the state and constant warfare and all kinds of, you know, drones flying out of it. But like, you know, the clown prince takes over and declares.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah.
If that happens, then I guess Dubai has a chance. But it seems to me that the UAE is really a big loser in this.
To some extent, it's already, it's gone. The dream of Dubai is gone, as one IRGC officer said. Because even if they get a good regime in Iran, even if they get that prince that's frolicking around meeting Zelensky and whatnot, if they get him in there, right, the reputation has already crumbled to the extent that the influencers and the freaks and all of those guys who left, I don't think are going to come back. I don't think, you know, seeing explosions here and there, waking up at 3 a.m. to explosions, that's not something you sort of can forget or move on from if you're not already living there and are from there, you know. I have someone I know in the area who was telling me that real estate prices have crashed there.
Yes.
So, you know,
I saw that it's down like 35%, the index, the real estate index there.
Yeah.
The United States is officially sending, and this whole thing, it's one of the most flimsy and unlikely stories to come out of this. The United States is supposedly sending a small fleet, basically consisting of those tilt wing
the Ospreys.
B-22s. And troop carriers of various types to calm the Gulf. and I would like to see that fleet go through the choke points in the Straits.
Well, I saw somewhere that aside from Karg, the other option for the Americans was that they were going to cross and establish a sort of beachhead on the other side of the Straits of Hormuz, i.e. the Iranian side, which if they try to do that, they will make Churchill and Gallipoli look like a genius move.
Yes. I mean, Iran has gamed all this.
Yes.
Many times.
The geography on the other sides of the strait, the Iranian side, is such that you have these mountains that are almost touching the water. So you land and you're faced with these mountains, and then what?
Yeah.
You know, Gallipoli was bad enough. So.
Well, you know, maybe we'll get some good songs out of it.
They're sending a force of 2,500 Marines and expeditionary force. But of that's actually roughly, I think, 1,200 actual infantry or fighters or whatever, and they maybe could double that. I mean, it's
war fighters,
just,
Mark. They're called war fighters.
War fighters, yeah, warriors. Actually, warriors. What are we, woke? I mean, it takes your breath away. It really does, because this whole war is so
assuming
stupid.
Their ships survived to get them near the shore.
Yeah,
because God knows what Iran has planned. There's been quite a long time to plan things.
Yeah, that opening scene in Private Ryan would look like Lover's Lane compared to, I think, what they would be dealing with. So, yeah. Right. Is there anything else we should add here? There's been a great conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time, Amr. And I think this really gives us a good sense of one Gulf state. it's nice to know that our country is not my country anyway. The U.S. is not the only one run by senile, dumb, inbred dotards, but that Bahrain is too. So solidarity in that.
We did.
Well, you used to have a genetic explanation like, oh, come on, why, this guy just happened to be born in the right family. Trump? No.
Yeah.
He was elected by morons.
Democratically elected, largest like ever, or something by a Republican. He is America.
That's the interesting thing, is that he got elected ostensibly on a platform of no more wars or whatever, which is, you know, whether it was bullshit or not, Americans believed it. But it does seem like there's no input in decision making anymore. Like, I look at the Democrats and I don't really see any of the leadership, the Democratic leadership.
There is.
There's no
opposition.
They
party.
Just decided we're going to play dumb for a while, and I'm not even sure they're playing at that.
Yeah. I'm sure half of them are secretly pleased that this is happening.
Your
Schumers
and your Jeffries and so forth.
Yeah.
Yeah, their loyalties in this are, frankly, to Israel, and it's good that Iran is being blasted, even if it fails, even if it breaks the U.S. armed forces. That's not so bad.
I mean, remember, even on immigration, the big idea, really the big idea for the campaign in 2024 that Biden had and the Democrats picked up as a kind of national party and then passed on to Harris, was that they were going to run to the right of Trump on immigration. And they tried pushing through a bill that was the strictest anti-immigration bill in many, many decades, and was much harder than the previous Trump one. And the Republicans voted it down because Trump didn't want to give them that. And the Democrats thought, now we can tell the Americans that we're more anti-immigrant than the Republicans. Ha ha. That's the mentality of this so-called opposition party. We don't have an opposition party.
But there's also never, what's baffling to me that stuck with me, I was a kid in 03, but as far as I understand, there was a serious effort to manufacture consent for that war. They had Powell go there with that vial of piss everything seems very hands off, very off, on autopilot, and no one. On the one hand, there's no attempt to manufacture consent. But on the other hand, there was some sort of million man march in New York about anti-war, and people expressed anti-war sentiments to Iran. There's not even that. Both sides seem to have resigned themselves to this. It feels very apathetic.
Yes, it's what you were describing in Bahrain, it's not from direct repression. But I think there's this sensibility in a lot of places in the world. It's the sense eventually that you can call this country democracy, you can call yours an enlightened monarchy or whatever, but there's this sense that no matter what you do, you actually have no input at all. And Trump has really shoved that in our faces. And frankly, so did Biden. I mean, there were mass protests, hard protests against the genocide in Gaza, across campuses and off campuses, and they were repressed by the by the liberals, and so there's just this sense that there's no politics in this country. So it's a real sullen. I wouldn't say it's resignation, because there's never been a war this unpopular when it started, and even when Americans are involved, it's never happened like this. But structurally, systemically, the American system of government, you know, it's an archaic system of government, and it centralizes all power on everything foreign policy, especially all power in the executive, in the presidency. So it's a very authoritarian rule of government, but other presidents have kind of, even George W. Bush kind of went through a certain motion to bring people on board. I mean, frankly, you know, dictators, Putin makes sure to get his people on board. Putin has all the power in Russia and a parliament that, you know, exists only in name pretty much. But they spend a lot of time and do worry about public opinion in Russia, even though it's a dictatorship. And, you know, what we found out here is that there aren't really checks and balances. There is just all power in one freak. And you can't really do anything about it. And maybe you can vote in now 3 years. But like, you only have one other choice. And the other guy is another version of Trump. Maybe not quite as dumb, maybe not quite as reckless, but not that different, ultimately. And so it's very demoralizing, dispiriting.
Yeah.
It feels like, it does feel like sort of somewhere between the Bourbon Restoration and like Tsarist Russia in terms of like the absence of politics as such.
But
we didn't even get into Kuwait. Look, I was talking to my family in Kuwait, and that's another interesting thing. As far as I understand, again, this is just some I've heard from people who know these things, the American casualty rates in the strikes on the Kuwait, the air base in Kuwait, are a lot higher than they're letting on in public. There's been a lot of evacuations to, I believe, some American hospital in Germany, in a base
right.
in Germany.
I've seen reports of this. Yeah, burn victim kind of hospitals and stuff like that. Yeah.
My family in Kuwait are in the Ministry of Interior and the Ministry of Defense, and they were saying that there were a lot of evacuations that had to be organized. Enough to suggest that the numbers they're giving out these days are not necessarily accurate. And Kuwait's been getting hammered this past week in particular.
Is that because the American presence there is really large, or is that because Kuwait has not had good relations with... Okay, because the American... Yeah, the
Kuwait
infrastructure...
Kuwait surprisingly has been less hostile to Iran than in a lot of the other Gulf countries, but the presence of the Americans is large. And it's also the defense is weaker. They've also run out of interceptors, so they've just been...
And the radars were taken out. I mean, they were really taken out in Kuwait. Well, I have to ask you, I don't know if you heard anything from there then about the ghosts of Kuwait.
So interestingly enough, there's rumors, and again, I don't know how true they are. I haven't been able to corroborate this. But from what I understand, they've arrested a Kuwaiti Air Force pilot. He is Shia. So make of that what you will. So the Kuwaiti Shia population has never been anti-government, really. The opposition to the government comes from the Sunni Islamists in Kuwait. It's a whole different dynamic there. But I don't know if they're arresting him because they're trying to maintain the facade that... it was a Kuwaiti pilot and not like an Iranian jet that no one wants to talk about. But yeah, this is all, I haven't been able to get confirmation. They've been very tight on OPSEC and whatnot over there. It does seem that there was an air-to-air confrontation. It wasn't what was initially reported, which was a Patriot or some sort of missile from the ground. It wasn't a ground-to-air thing. It was air-to-air.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so you have all these American bases there that are supposed to secure them, and it turns out the bases are what is attracting the destruction of these fragile Gulf state countries' economies while Israel is being well-protected. I mean, it's...
Aside from protecting the Gulf countries... I thought the purpose of a military base was to protect its inhabitants. It's the soldiers you put inside the base.
Yeah.
So why are they moving them to fucking hotels? Wasn't the point of the base to protect them from attack? Yeah.
It's amazing. Now they're asking basically the defenseless citizens to protect them with their bodies and hiding them. Anyways, well, this has been a great discussion. I really appreciate it. I mean, this does give us a sense, certainly of Bahrain... And a bit of Kuwait as well. I mean, we should do another episode sometime soon, more focusing on Kuwait, which, as you said, has been getting absolutely hammered. that'd be really interesting as well. Yeah. But this has been great. I really appreciate it, Amr.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks. Okay, that was our discussion with Amr about Bahrain in the U.S.-Israel war on Iran. Thanks again, everyone. Thank you, John, Brendan, and Amr. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.